Mini episode 677 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by The Unheard Scene, your home for great music interviews of all stripes. Follow them on the web at unheardscene.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everybody, to FDH Lounge mini episode number 677. Rick Morris, Anthony Petrone. Breaking down, making a murderer. We are joining the national craze here. We are going through the Netflix series that has everybody coast to coast flummoxed, trying to make sense of what happened with this case, this national obsession. We are jumping on top of it here. We're going to give you our 2 cents worth. We're going to go through, try and give you hopefully a unique FDH Lounge perspective on this. We've watched it. We've talked a lot off air. I know that not all of my thoughts track with his. But that's good, because I think that'll make for a better discussion rather than if we were seeing everything the same way. So this is a lot to get into. We're going to work to keep the first part of this thing here spoiler-free. And then beyond that, we'll let you know at what point, okay, close your ears, do whatever you got to do, but shut them ear holes, because we will be getting into the spoilers of the thing. But in the meantime, Anthony, we're just going to break this thing down and go through what led us up to the murder case and the timeline of this. So good to have you on. I'm glad you're here to break this down with me. And what were your overall thoughts when you got through this thing?
My overall thoughts is it makes you wonder how the police system around you works, how they think, is this what the majority of the police companies, police groupings, whatever, sorry, bad words,
okay,
are like. It makes you wonder if I ever get arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to be stuck somewhere? You know, I don't have a whole lot of money to defend myself. Is it only the wealthy who can defend themselves?
It raises a lot of very interesting questions. We obviously start from the standpoint of Stephen Avery. This is in northern Wisconsin, up on Lake Michigan, Manitowoc County. And he is a guy who was jailed in 1985 for a rape that it turns out he did not commit. There was evidence at the time. He was identified by the rapist out of a lineup, Penny Ann Bernstein, and it should have been actually Gregory Allen. He is the guy who ended up having raped her, but Avery went away for a long time. It took until DNA evidence could surface in 2003, 18 years that he had been away. Subsequently, he is released on 9/11 of 2003. He is set free from jail, gets a hero's welcome at home, and tries to reacclimate to the family compound here, the Avery Salvage Yard. This is a family-owned business. They all seem to own houses / shanties / trailers / lean-tos / whatever on the premises.
there's something there.
Yeah.
Maybe some of them live in a few of them 3,500 cars.
They might. They might, yeah. Hey, this thing's practically an RV. Yeah. So, I mean, and this family, again, there is a lot to talk about with this entire clan of people. It doesn't help matters as we're going through that they are pretty much loathed in the local community, and we're going to talk about that as we go along here. Stephen Avery's reputation, he himself was not exactly Snow White before he went away to jail. He had been picked up. He had gone away for some burglary action one time for burning a cat, and we're going to get into a little bit of the framing of the documentary because the documentarians let him get away with portraying it as, I was there with my friends. It was kind of a peer pressure situation. I tossed this cat over the fire, and nope, oh, wouldn't you know it, caught fire. Yeah, nothing in there about how he doused the cat in flammable oil, tried to get it to burn.
Well, that's neither here nor there.
It doesn't mean that he killed anybody, but can you understand how, when you're looking at the mind of a monster, potentially, how that could feed in?
Well, the thing that gets me about that whole thing is he admitted to it. You know, there was another thing in there about that robbery. He pled guilty to both of those.
Yes, he did.
So, you know, he didn't really hide from anything there. Mm-hmm. Now, even if you are guilty, if you do admit guilt, you're not going to leave more stuff there than is necessary. You're
going
to tell exactly what the minimum is. You don't want to get yourself in more trouble than you have to.
Sure. But and I understand, again, and this is a guy with an IQ of 70. So that phrase, not the brightest bulb, quite frankly, doesn't even come close to covering this. So,
well, that was also in school, too. Now,
okay.
They said that was in school. Now, given the fact that he isn't a man now, mm-hmm. what did he learn in jail? What did he, you know,
okay.
he spent a lot of time in jail.
He did.
So
he did.
What did he learn while he was there? Where did his IQ grow while he was there?
He went away to Con College, as they say on the Trailer Park Boys. But, you know, that was a thing where he ended up away for the 18 years. And that seems to be the heart of the story here of either there was a murder that happened in 2005, which is the center of this story. Either he committed this murder, and this is all very dense to this day as far as trying to get your arms around, in which case he is a murderer and he is where he belongs, or he did not commit the murder, and it ends up being a situation where the rightful perpetrator of this would still be at large. And the situation specifically, in late 2005, 2 years after he'd been released from jail, he was pursuing a civil action against the county, and it was going to go for, I believe, $36 million potentially for wrongful imprisonment and everything else, and quite frankly, a great deal of fraud, because they uncovered a couple of perpetrators here, Sergeant Andrew Colburn and Lieutenant James Lenk, in the Sheriff's Department, who sat on evidence that came up in 1995 that he may have been innocent of the rapes. They had gotten a report in that there had been some rumor of a confession by the real rapist, which would have exonerated him, gotten him out of the jail 10 years through the 18 years that he spent in jail. So these guys are being deposed. Other witnesses, other county employees are being deposed. It's this ongoing kind of a thing, and this murder ends up happening right in the middle of it. And it's one of these things where you have to look on the surface and say, at the very least, the timing on this is the world's most incredible coincidence, if he did do it, or it's a setup to try to get out of this judgment, because the insurance company wasn't going to be liable for this. The insurance company let the county know, hey, you and your employees are going to be on the hook. Now, you know, I'm sure that the county could have tried to take the insurance company to court, but that's an entirely separate matter. The county and these employees are looking at being on the hook for $36 million in judgment when this young woman, Teresa Halbach, goes missing on the property, and subsequently her body is found in burned, charred, almost nearly destroyed form.
Well, a lot of people, and like you said, timing, a lot of people had a lot to lose. I mean, because I rewatched a few episodes, as you know.
Yeah.
And after rewatching episode one, Peggy Bernstein herself even saw a picture of Gary Allen at that point and said, well, what about him?
Right.
And they told us, no, we have the guy. Don't worry about it.
Right.
So, you know, when those things come out, it makes you wonder, do you get rid of somebody? Do you frame him for something else? Or you just let it just go?
Well, that is a very good question, because this Teresa Halbach goes missing on the property. And it was October 31st of 2005. She was a freelance photographer who was working for Auto Trader magazine. She had been out there previously to take pictures of Avery family vehicles that they were selling, and this was another instance of that. Now, there are some things that weren't much covered in the documentary, and this is where a lot of people are doing their own sleuthing. They're looking around, you know, to see, Reddit is full of such people right now, and you've got a situation where people are uncovering facts such as, and this I think was uncontested at trial, the fact that Teresa Halbach had been previously kind of creeped out by Stephen Avery. The one time she showed up to take pictures, he greeted her in a towel and I guess was kind of judged to be leering at her, at least in her opinion. And also, he, Star 67, called her cell phone a couple times on the day of her disappearance. So what did that mean? As we go along, there are some other theories. Quite frankly, some of the stuff here, if he did have any kind of a fixation with her, because, again, his fiancée, Jody, was away, at this time, Jody Stankowski, she was serving a lot of time on a DUI, so he was without a woman in his life regularly around at this point here. If he had a fixation with Teresa, ironically, that could have been used to frame him, and we'll get into that when we pass the point of the spoilers here, but going up to the point here of the murder, and we're sort of rapidly getting to the point here where everything past this is going to be spoilers. She disappears on that date, and I think this is about where we should probably declare the spoiler part starting, because everything here starts to get to that. So from here on in, it's all spoilers. She disappears, of course. She's gone for, I think, like 3 days before her roommate, her platonic male roommate, Scott Blodorn, ends up reporting this, I think, to her parents and also the police. I don't know the exact chain of events here, but one thing kind of led to another as far as the timing of that.
The timing was he decided she was missing.
Yes.
Contacted her ex-boyfriend, which this that whole part weirds me out right there.
Right.
Instead of contacting her parents or contacting the police.
Right.
He contacted her ex-boyfriend.
Right.
Who then came over and they went into her singular wireless account and checked her phone records.
Right.
Okay. After hacking into it, why on earth would that be the first thing you do?
Right.
If somebody hasn't been around, the first person I'm making, say it's my sister, I'm calling my parents.
Have right.
you heard or seen from her?
Right.
And then I'm calling the police. I'm not hacking into any phone records. I'm not doing anything illegal.
Right. Because that's what happened, because the ex-boyfriend, Ryan Hillegas, who was still very good friends with her over a period of time, the movie does not make clear who dumped who or whatever, if it was a mutual thing, whatever the case may be.
You'll never know.
They dated in college. This was post-college sometime, remained good friends. The male roommate was a platonic male roommate, so a lot of people out there, a lot of internet sleuths are ascribing sort of motivations to these guys. The one sketchy thing, as you said, that did happen is that they, and I think this was before the police, yeah, this was before the police were even alerted. They hacked into her phone, as you said, and it was when we say hacked into it, it was a thing of, let's try to figure out what the password is. So it was try, oh, succeed, we got it. And they got in there, and again, you know, that's tampering with evidence, because we don't exactly know what, if anything, got erased. So that part of it's kind of sketchy. A search party subsequently is amassed, and her family is participating in it, friends of the family, and they end up stumbling out and end up in the vicinity of the compound, because I don't think anybody knew at the beginning that the last place she'd been seen was on Stephen Avery's compound, the family compound at the salvage yard.
With a lot of talk, it seemed like they had an idea.
Mm-hmm.
That I guess they had spoken with Auto Trader and Auto Trader, where she was employed, told them that that was her last stop of the day.
Right. But by the way, and again, and it was more of a freelance thing in terms of her employment, here's a wistful kind of a thing that I have read subsequently. That was, and I read a sensationalistic headline of, abducted on her last day with Auto Trader. Not exactly, but apparently her freelance thing was kind of blowing up, and she was going to have to kind of focus more on the business that she was accruing as opposed to taking these freelance assignments. So she was on the verge of being free from such obligations, which just kind of makes it a little bit harder to stomach when you think about this poor woman getting abducted in her mid-20s. One of her, I think this is a second cousin of hers, one of her relatives, Pamela Sturm, ends up, they had gotten permission, I guess, from somebody in the Avery family to look on the lot.
Chuck.
And from Chuck Avery, yes, from Stephen's brother, who, more about him later, because there are a lot of sketchy people in this family. So Chuck, either naively, because he is sure that his brother and everyone associated with the family didn't do this, or perhaps because he may know a little something-something, says, sure, go ahead, whatever. This entire gigantic salvage yard, Pamela Sturm ends up, I think in the span of about 20 to 30 minutes, honing in on the vehicle, a 1999 green RAV4, finds it on the lot, and calls the police, and they said, hey, don't get in there, but don't touch it, don't tamper with evidence. But the thing is, and you listened to the call the same as I did, Anthony, on one of the episodes here, and she's sounding kind of halting, kind of like a little bit kind of like, I don't exactly know what I'm looking at or what to look for or whatever. I found something out very interesting. Would you believe, based on your remembrance of the way this woman conducted herself, she's actually a private investigator?
No.
I've read that. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't buy that for a second.
She is. So if you're thinking this whole thing is kind of an act as far as her stumbling across the vehicle and calling the police like, oh, what do I do? Eh, I'm not real sure about what we got going on here. Eh, if you're a little suspicious about that, you might be right. And that was something that really didn't kind of add up. But from there, they get the vehicle, they find some blood inside, and it's kind of a straight downhill path from there. Before you know it, before too much more time has gone by, they've got a search warrant. They're tearing up the premises. The Avery family was exiled from there for like 8 days. They had to go to like their cabin in the woods, I guess, and stay there while it was getting torn up. And on the property, burned, charred remains of hers, bones, teeth, the stuff that, again, I'm not a serial killer, so pardon me for not being an expert on this, but I'm going to guess the stuff that's probably hardest to get destroyed completely. Some of those remnants were there, found in a burn pit. But again, you and I have read different things on this as far as were they intertwined with radials in a burn pit, or were they, the consensus seems to be that they were put there.
It actually said in the show
mm-hmm.
that they were intertwined with radials.
It did say that, okay.
It actually did say that.
Okay.
Like I said, I've been rewatching it.
Okay.
But, you know, still that doesn't mean a whole lot.
Right. It still seems, and again, could have been intertwined with radials from elsewhere. The other thing is, too, there are questions about the heat of a mere bonfire as far as disposing with a body, because I've read this about, say, for example, Indian culture, where cremation is a big part of the culture over there and where they're disposing of bodies, and that there's only so much you can do with an open fire as opposed to a crematorium.
Right, because crematoriums, those fires are hot.
I mean,
really hot. They're
super concentrated.
They're not a regular fire.
That's right. That's right. It's very concentrated. And that's how they're able to get it, you know, and that's how you get a thing where, you know, somebody comes out clutching an urn, here's grandma's ashes, and you look at it and it looks like pretty much real ashes, and, you know, like you can't hardly find any trace of a human person having been in there versus this method of, oh, look, there's her tooth, there's part of a shin bone or what have you, and this kind of thing here. So, you know, you're not going to get the same kind of effect.
You mean you can't put it together?
Yeah, this is not Humpty Dumpty, but it was a very, very gross and unfortunate set of circumstances here. So they're finding enough on the property that they end up, okay, they've honed in on him as the prime suspect, but let's backtrack ever so slightly. He was, from the outset, the only suspect slash person of interest. And as far as when there came down the immediate thing of, oh, there may have been a disappearance at the property, or her. I think it was when her vehicle was found on the property. Then it was a thing of, is somebody else radioed in? Is he in custody yet?
Yes, and I don't know how much we're talking outside the show or what we investigated.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Strang said he was not the only suspect. He was the only one they investigated.
That's right. Well, officially, though, the only suspect, right? Okay.
Right.
Dean Strang, one of the two superstar attorneys who came on board subsequently. We'll get to that when it gets to trial. But he did have excellent representation beyond his initial public defender stage that he was in. But keep in mind, all of this happened at the same time as this civil suit, that it was really kind of drawing to a head with the depositions. He really kind of had them on the ropes for, if not the $36 million, then maybe a very good chunk of that. And the county, again, potentially being on the hook for a lot of it vis-a-vis the insurance company. So, and we're jumping around on the timeline a little bit here in terms of this, but I think there's no escaping that when you're trying to talk about the story. that the thing, the civil trial, immediately that becomes his only potential source of income for good representation, because simultaneous to all this, in the 2 years that he was out, he had become, and that's the interesting thing here, you know, quite a hero at the State House in Wisconsin. Oh, here's this poor guy that spent 18 years on there. We're going to pass a bill. We're going to try and make sure nothing like this can happen again. They even named it, you know, the Stephen Avery bill, whatever. It passed, actually, the day after Teresa Halbach's disappearance. So before anybody had any inkling it was him, because her disappearance was not reported for 3 days. Subsequently, that gets signed into law, and the legislature, the legislator who spearheaded the bill, called the governor and said, look, we got to follow through with this thing, but obviously it doesn't look good because it's his name on it, and maybe he actually did do this thing. So if you want to sign it behind closed doors, do it. So the cause of trying to make sure that nobody could get railroaded again continued on. But as far as the process went, that was it. Because there was another separate thing pending to try to get Stephen Avery and anybody else this happens to guaranteed compensation from the state, financial compensation for the time that he was away. And that bill stalled and pretty much died as soon as he became public suspect number one, and the town was very ready to believe, and the community, that he actually did it this time. So he had no chance of getting the compensation money from the state of Wisconsin for what he'd gone through. So now he's looking at the civil suit for everything. Because, again, this guy's living hand-to-mouth. He's working for the family business at the salvage yard there, but living in a trailer on the site. I mean, not making hardly anything. He's not going to be able to afford big-time big-time representation. So he settles with the state. He takes a pennies on the dollar settlement of $400,000. Of that, you got a good chunk going to the attorneys who've been representing him all along.
And $160,000. I found those numbers.
Yeah, that's the part that was his. $160,000.
He
gave $160,000. He gave $160,000 to the lawyers. Okay, so it ends up being $240,000 left, and that's what's able to get him to afford this good representation. This is a team that ultimately was it was pieced together. They never worked together before. Dean Strang and Jerry Booting, both of whom were very good lawyers, both of whom had brought their own sort of specialization to the case, and they handled it together. And I think you could see from the documentary, meshed very well for guys who had never worked together before. Both of them very talented and very good public speakers, very good framers of arguments in court, very skilled at what they did. But in the early part of this case, the community is very ready to believe that he did it. For a guy who was away for 18 years, and that's one of the things that you and I found jarring when we watched this, and continue to find jarring to a certain extent, is when a guy goes away for 18 years on a bad rap, even if he comes from, and again, I'm going to say this, me personally anyways, you know, from a barrel of bad apples, if you will. This family, you know, and sometimes there's things of framing in a documentary. It's what you say and what you don't say. And so it's not exactly a lie of omission, but it's certainly like a twisting by omission of, well, nobody in the family kind of liked these lower middle class people who ran a salvage yard thing, and people looked at them as white trash and troublemakers, and you expect to hear the faint sounds of friends in low places in the background, as though, gee, if only these downtrodden folks knew what salad fork to use, maybe people would like them more. Wow. And I'm sitting here, and I'm going, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Right. They've been away for a bunch of crimes, Stephen Avery himself included. I mean, this whole thing of, like, the implicit unasked question of, like, why doesn't the community like the Averys? It doesn't seem that complicated to me. Now, why they jumped to the assumption he did this after the bad rap previously, to me, that's another story. But the larger story of why don't people like right. the Averys?
Well, people don't like different.
Yeah.
And, you know, and
people also don't like criminals. Well, people don't like having their houses broken into.
But they weren't all criminals, though. I mean, they did a few bad things, but they weren't all criminals. I mean, I didn't find anything on the parents.
Well, no, but that's in terms of, and we'll talk about them a little bit more. So some of the alternate suspects in this case, who Stephen himself has kind of fingered here. Charles Avery, this is from from documents that were filed as part of his appeals process. Charles had record here, a police report of sexually harassing a woman at the yard who had reported to her coworkers she was afraid of him. This was a case that was dropped subsequently, but was charged with sexual assault by his wife at the time. And so this is a guy who, again, he had a little bit less of a concrete criminal record. Earl Avery, pretty concrete. Another one of the brothers here charged. He pleaded no contest, which, by the way, no contest is just another way of saying guilty. Sexually assaulting his two daughters in 1995. So there's that. So he's a class human being. And you've got somebody who's been on the hook for that and for other things here. So just starting with the brothers. You got a couple of bad apples in the mix here. You got some other folks who've had some criminal issues. As you said, the parents, I don't think, seem to be in this. But you throw in Stephen's own history of stuff. But then that's where it gets to the whole, you know, prejudicing the community, prejudicing law enforcement. You and I were laughing about this in terms of our remembrance of seeing this in the police video. They're going through there. And this is on the official, this is a video that the sheriff's department, I think, itself was taking. And, you know, one of the female patrol women said something like, when she came across a couple of his shoes, should we take these in so we have a file for footprints the next time there's a burglary somewhere?
Right. And that right there killed me.
Yeah.
And I know it was funny, and I know we laughed about it, but that right there could tell you, hey, we're going to set him up to frame him some more.
Right. And the part that's unclear, there are so many different angles to this thing. It's unclear to me in terms of whether that woman employee was with Calumet County or whether she was with Manitowoc County, because Manitowoc County, as soon as this thing went down, they recused themselves, because this is before the civil suit was eventually ended. And everybody looked at it and said, hey, conflict of interest. You are identifying as the prime suspect in a sensational murder case, somebody who is suing you for a buttload of money, who can have an adverse effect, who can basically shut down the county financially if he wins this thing. So Calumet County comes in, and we'll talk about their prosecutor a little bit later, because he's a real piece of work in my estimation.
Ken Kratz,
yeah. So it was supposed to be Calumet County law enforcement even taking the lead on the premises there, doing the investigating at the Avery compound, and specifically his trailer, the garage that was adjacent to it, other grounds around there, and the places outside where they found this. Having said that, our good friends Lenk and Colburn end up inserting themselves into the story again. James Lenk, who, if I remember correctly, without having signed into the ledger there to get on site that day, ends up on site, is in his bedroom, the bedroom of Stephen Avery. What was it, 8 days, I think?
It was on the third. They were there 8 days, but it was on the third day.
Yeah.
And the Calumet County Sheriff's Department, from my understanding of rewatching and rewatching,
yeah,
there was only one Calumet officer there.
That's right.
The rest were Manitowoc.
I think you're right, yeah.
And he gave the impression at one point that he really didn't care.
Right.
What was going on the premises.
Yeah, and, you know, when he was asked about it in court, pretty much openly admitted, hey, if they wanted to pull something, they could have pulled something. I can only be one place at a time.
Correct.
So Lenk shows up, and mysteriously, this key appears that was said to have, what, fallen off of his bookcase in his bedroom?
Right.
Okay, yeah. Moving stuff around. Hey, not like anything hadn't been moved around in the 3 days previously, but stuff's getting moved around, and, oh, here's the key to Teresa Halbach's RAV4, and I think this is the thing that basically moved it to the stage of deciding to prosecute him when they found the evidence there. And it had, for whatever reason, only his DNA on the key. Somebody had wiped it clean, and it had only his DNA and not hers on it, which is ridiculous. It's for her vehicle.
She had owned the car for 7 years. There should have been some DNA. I'm sure if you test my keys right now, and yeah, I haven't owned that car but a month, my DNA's on there.
That's right. That's right. So you got that going on. You got all kinds of things here that are just extremely, extremely suspicious. Subsequently, as they're checking other of the DNA stuff on site there, Sherry Culhane, who had, during the first trial, I believe I've read this, and I think this is true. I think she may have mishandled some stuff in the first trial. I'm not 100% clear on that, but she did mishandle some stuff here because she admitted that while she was going through, that she had a couple of people who were, I guess, training to work in forensics. And she was taking them through and sort of teaching as she was going. Well, that's fine, so long as nothing goes wrong. But she, in the course of, and this is a best-case scenario in terms of honesty, that maybe she's distracted because she's both teaching stuff and trying to execute it at the same time, gets some of her DNA on one of the samples out there and has to say in court, well, yeah, mine's on it too, but that doesn't taint, that doesn't take away from the fact that his was on it as well. So she's trying to say that it's untainted by her mistake.
Right, and it gets me that it was just a bullet from his gun.
Right.
That was found in the garage. It wasn't found anywhere in relation to Teresa Halbach.
Yes.
It was just found under a machine in the garage.
Yes.
Now, he hunts. Mm-hmm. He goes other places. I'm sure you'll find many bullets with his DNA on it.
That's right. And that's one of the weird things, though. Her DNA, her blood, whatever, not found anywhere in the garage. I mean, with the possible exception of that bullet. I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing her DNA was probably on the bullet. But no other blood, no other DNA found anywhere in the garage. All kinds of things that are extraordinarily sketchy about that whole thing. It was just really a travesty in terms of trying to get your arms around that, because there's as much evidence that looks like it could have been planted as there was to indicate that he could have done it. It really still could have broken either way at this point, but based on what they had there, based on the charred remnants of the bones, teeth, whatever, things that were found, I think I may have read something about a stray toe as well. None of these things that the human mind wants to linger on very long. Regardless, they had enough that they felt like they could take him in. And, again, the community seemed very ready to believe very early on, particularly when it came out, okay, last person to see her alive. Okay, that's kind of all we need here at this point. So he gets taken in, and there are other people being questioned about what they know, but not questioned in the sense of, hey, where were you when this happened? So the questioning kind of surrounds everything as it relates to Stephen Avery with other people and trying to establish any potential kinds of alibis, essentially. And his alibi, a big part of his alibi, is that he was around in the afternoon and that his nephew, Brendan Dassey, was around there and could vouch for his whereabouts, and that he subsequently was somebody that could say, yeah, Stephen Avery was here, the story checks out, she came, she got her picture taken, she took the picture of the car, they whatever. She supposedly gave him an Auto Trader magazine, and it was found in his bedroom. That doesn't necessarily prove anything, but again, that she was there on site. His story is she drove away. And Brendan Dassey is backing her. He is backing him up on the story here for much of this. So it's going along, and then months later, you skip ahead to the beginning of March 2006. So after Stephen Avery's been in jail for about 5 months, and they're working on the case, and this Ken Kratz, let's go to him here for a second just to kind of set the tone on that, because
okay.
Yeah, him and his stupid soft woman voice. That guy, and I've talked about this with you off air, that there's a number of people here where it just seems like it's almost like it's a TV drama, in the sense that you write these things in just to sort of complicate the arc of a show a little bit more. And he brought to this the kind of, at the very least, public attitude, whatever his private thoughts were, a public attitude, which really only complicated matters here, because that first press conference that he had, you know, if it's me and I'm put in that position, I am made special prosecutor because I'm the DA from the next county, and the county itself is going to rule itself out of handling it. The first thing I do is I take a deep breath in front of the cameras, and I say, okay, bear with me here. This is a tough spot to be in. I know this guy got sent away for 18 years for something that he didn't do. I'll grant you that. But we have evidence that points to him actually having done this. For Ken Kratz, there's none of that. The first press conference, he just gets in there, and it's boom, 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 this piece of human waste who's never been any good for society, we're sending him away, he did this. And you're just looking at it going, you know, in the one sense, it seems like he's needlessly complicating this, because if he would give a little bit and be like even one tiny scintilla of being a human being in that moment and admitting that, like, look, this is a bad situation for us to be in, but we think we can prove that he did it, as opposed to just straight ahead. I mean, right. His attitude, talk about how it made you feel.
Well, it made me look at our law enforcement again.
Mm-hmm.
Because after doing a lot of research, a prosecutor should never be like that.
Yeah.
A prosecutor should never have a burden of guilt in your mind when you start.
Yeah.
The prosecutor is all about finding the truth and whether that person did it or not.
Right.
It's not about saying this person did it, this person's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how deep does this go? Is this Calumet County trying to stand up for Manitowoc County? I don't know. You know, it's an awful thing to straight up say he's a horrible person, he deserves this, we're going to get him. That whole press conference was absurd.
Yeah. He was trying to set the tone for the case. And it was setting a tone, essentially, of trying the case in the media, which, again, there are things that, again, we're legal laymen. You and I are not lawyers. We're watching this out there like everybody else, just trying to piece it together, aside from the people who are lawyers who can maybe see a couple of the things that happened and understand what went down. But that was part number one of trying this in the media. Part number two came after Brendan Dassey got cracked, essentially, and was made to turn on his uncle. What happened was, I guess things had gotten back to the prosecution and their continuing investigation into the case and what happened. Subsequently, it was Brendan's first cousin who, again, she was either lying at his trial or she was lying when she reported this, but basically got a sense from talking to him that he was kind of breaking down from guilt, that he knew Stephen Avery did it and that he had participated in it. And it was his cousin Kayla's, whoever she reported this to, whether it was at school, whether it was directly to the police, whatever, they end up bringing him in. And a couple of guys by the name of Tom Fassbender, who was a Wisconsin Division of Criminal Investigation investigator, so a state cop, and Mark Wiegert, a sergeant at the Calumet County Sheriff's Office. They bring him in, and the long and short of this is they talk to him extensively without his mom being there, without any public defender being there, without anybody. They say that his mom was like, okay, yeah, do what you got to do, but that doesn't really seem
she
likely.
She later denied it.
She later said,
I never said that.
And I think she seems pretty credible on this. And you watch the snippets of this, and it's really snippets in a 10-hour documentary, the parts that are focused on his quote-unquote confession out of a 4-hour confession that he made.
You can watch the whole thing.
It's online.
It is on YouTube.
Yes.
It's a 4-part. They're 1 hour apiece.
Yes. And I don't know a great many of us that really have the ability to kind of stomach extended versions of that. From what I've read of transcripts, not all of it is as bad as it looks in the documentary, that there are parts where he's actually talking a little bit more coherently about what happened. But the part that's in the documentary, which I have to believe is probably representative of the thing as a whole, is they're doing everything but putting words in his mouth. This is a kid, by the way, IQ alert. We talked about Stephen before at 70. The kid is a like 69 or 70, supposedly. So another guy out of this.
Well, they did say he was in special needs classes.
Yeah.
They did say he was taking special needs courses at Mishicot High School.
And it's clear. You could tell from looking at the kid. And that's where and I had to laugh too, cuz he later on, you know, evinces a little bit of concern about I'm worried that I might not be home to watch WrestleMania, whereupon I texted FDH Lounge dignitary Kyle Ross, who does our ongoing wrestling coverage with me, and I said, this kid's not doing a lot for the image of us pro wrestling fans, I'll tell you that. You know,
I hate to tell you. But anyways, no, I will say I did watch a greater part of it.
What'd you think of it?
He did speak a lot on himself, but okay. It was still only after they put this whole story in his head.
Yeah.
And the reason this bothers me is I do know people who have been convicted of crimes, mm-hmm. and they try to get you to pull over on somebody else,
right,
to make it easier on you. I have seen it, and this happens everywhere.
Yes.
And if you watch the video, this bothers me more than anything. Not only would they do this, you know, mm-hmm. they would do this to an average person like you or I,
yes,
but they would do this to a special needs person that bad,
yep,
without his mother,
yeah,
without an attorney. And you know, when he did speak, it yep. was things that they had already said.
And then eventually, like, they kept waiting for him to get to the part about a gunshot to the head. And then finally, one of them just blurts it out impatiently about, who shot her in the head or, you know. And then, like, the kid kind of takes the story from there. He's going, it's very clear, this is a dim kid who is going on their clues. He is following the path that they want him to follow.
Well, he thought they had something on him.
Yeah.
And if you're not that bright, you're going to think that they've got something on you. You're shaking in your boots. You're going to tell them. They're telling him the whole time, you won't be in trouble. You won't be in trouble. You won't be in trouble. I mean, this is a kid who got done with the interview after confessing to murder and rape and said, can I go back to class?
Yeah, yeah. He thought he was going back to class. And it's one of these things where, again, you have to look at that and say that that is, I would have to believe, considered unethical and unprofessional in that profession. You've got somebody who, again, is not, you know, few among us would be equipped to probably stand up to a situation with, yeah, sure, I'll take it on without a lawyer. Do your worst, you know. Few among us would want to take that on, let alone this kid who looks like a lamb getting led to slaughter.
Right. In the past couple of days, I have spoken to somebody who, with an average IQ, has been in that situation.
Okay.
And they were convicted of something. They uh-huh. were going to be convicted of something.
Right.
But there were two other accomplices who were they were looking to get more on.
Okay.
And they do. I mean, they put he thought, just like Brandon Dassey did,
right,
I can do this.
Right.
I can do this. But those people are trained.
Right.
Those people know what they're hunting for. They know what they're looking for. They know what buttons they're pushing. And like I said, that's why that bothers me.
Well, that's flat-out predatory to take this poor, dim kid of you're going to be okay. That's why the kid thinks he's going to skate. That's why the kid thinks he's going back for sixth period at school afterwards, because it's what they told him, essentially. Well, and they can always hide behind, well, we never said he was going to get off scot-free, that he was not going to suffer any kind. You know, telling him that he's going to be fine if he does this, you know what I mean? And in terms of the kid's ability to process what happened to him, right afterwards, they're like, okay, well, you know, we're going to have to keep you here after all. And first, we got to check you for weapons. And do you have any weapons on you? Well, I just have this disc player here. The kid doesn't know that a disc player is not a weapon. Later on, he's talking to his mom, who, again, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It never does in this family, basically, as far as asking, you know, about the stories. And this is where he starts to hint to his mom, and as he later says flat out, they messed with my head, you know, they put these thoughts in my head. But as he's asking his mom about what if Steven tells a different story, and they said something about if the stories are inconsistent, neither the kid nor his mom knew the meaning of the word inconsistent.
Right.
And that's another kind of a side thing here about this family. Again, of all the amateur sleuths out there, there have been some people, and it's interesting because sometimes people are able to bring their own professional skill set to bear on this, whatever. People who are understanding in the science of lead poisoning have looked at this and said, look, that salvage yard out there, you can only imagine how much lead is in the water, slash got into the groundwater, slash has been consumed by these people. All I know is after looking at this bunch, I wouldn't drink a glass of water out of those taps if you paid me $1 million.
I don't know that that did, Dendo.
Thank you, Stephen Avery. That's an uncanny impersonation, actually, of Stephen Avery. And again, these people, you know, look, you know, I wouldn't be, I don't like to be a bully. I wouldn't be sitting here laughing about this kind of stuff if they were all people who minded their own business and never broke the law. But we have a seeming history of that running through this clan here, albeit with this kid and with his mom in this way. Again, they're traumatized by what happens. But Ken Kratz, oh, it seemingly is the greatest day of his life once this goes down, because you talk about trying to taint a jury pool, which, again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know the intricacies, but like a lot of people, I know broad strokes. I know things that you're, basic things you're not supposed to do. I couldn't tell you beyond the basic things, but one of the basic things is it is considered unethical to try to taint a jury pool. You're not supposed to throw a splashy press conference with the overt hopes that this is great. This will get on the evening news. The entire community is going to think this guy's a sick bastard that should be locked up and thrown away. This case is going to be a layup. You're not supposed to do that. And all you got to do is watch the clips that they're showing on there is to see this. And he's even doing the whole kind of, you know, fake, you know, sympathy thing here of, you know, for those of you who've got children, I would advise them to leave the room right now,
right,
or plug
right,
your ears.
Right.
Yeah. As he gets into the graphic details, and supposedly, Brendan confessed to the fact that he stumbled upon this. He was taking some mail to Stephen Avery's place, right in the trailer right next door where him and his mom lived, and his brother. More about his brother in a little bit, too. But he stumbles upon this. His uncle comes to the door, basically mid-rape, leads him down the hallway, and there's Teresa, who supposedly is bound and shackled to the bed. He's raping her. He forces the nephew to go along with this. The nephew rapes her also. They cut her throat, but she's still not dead yet. She thrashes around some more, eventually gets like punched in the head a lot, eventually shot to death. This entire story, but there's not a speck of her blood or her DNA anywhere in his trailer. Nor, like I said, aside from potentially that bullet that's found in the garage, is there anything in the garage there? So this kid's story doesn't stand up to the forensic evidence. Nancy Grace is running around saying otherwise right now, but that's not the case.
And if you bleached it,
mm-hmm,
his DNA wouldn't be in there.
That's
but
right.
But they found his DNA in the bedroom, in the garage, everywhere where this allegedly took place. They found his DNA.
That's
which
right.
Means there's no way possible that they could have bleached that entire apartment, because you wouldn't have found his DNA.
Yeah, it was there. It was all over the place. So the kid's story doesn't even hold up. And it turns out that the kid's story, it's deemed flimsy enough in the case of Stephen Avery's trial that they decide not to introduce it into evidence. But
after they had told the jurors.
That's right. Oh, yeah, yeah, that. And that's one of the things here, too, and I had read this in one of the tabloids in recent days here. One of the tabloids, because everybody's all over this at this point, one of them had a thing of, like, new evidence that may free him or get Stephen Avery a new trial, at least. And it turns out what it is it's not evidence related to the murder. It's evidence related to the murder trial, because the jury is not allowed to take that into account. Now, this is one of these things where, again, Ken Kratz, you can't walk away from this without saying this is one of the most cynical SOBs who ever lived, because you can't unring the bell. You know, he put that out there on the evening news. He, by the way, and this has been substantiated by Strang and Booting, the defense team here, he excluded employees, I think they were engineers, at a local nuclear power plant because he was overtly looking for the dumbest jury that he could get his hands on. And they were basically like, you don't have to give cause, you can just exclude somebody. So he in his head is thinking, okay, that guy's too smart, gone. That guy's too smart, gone. So he's got the jury that he's looking for. They've already seen the evening news, although they're not supposed to think about it, and they've heard this testimony that it turns out, okay, pretend you didn't hear that. You can't unring the bell.
Right.
And that's where Now, if it can be proven, if any of the jurors who are now dissenting from the verdict and saying they were strong-armed into going along with it, or there's one juror who left the case at the 11th hour because of a family emergency. His daughter was in a car accident as they were deliberating.
We'll get to that soon. I got thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because the conspiracy theorists of the world are having a ball with that one. But this is a thing where, in looking at it, you know, ultimately, if they took that into account, that's cause for a mistrial right there. And that jurors are basically admitting, that supposedly off the record, that they took this inadmissible stuff into court. I'm almost thinking for right now, maybe what I want to do is, even though it happened afterwards, is maybe kind of get Brandon's trial out of the way and come back to Stevens' one, because it's more straightforward. I mean, the kid basically recants his testimony, but he doesn't get up on the stand, or he does get up on the stand to testify, and they pick him apart. They just absolutely pick him apart. His cousin, Kayla, this is one of these damned if you do, damned if you don't things, she was brought up there, and she recanted the entire story. And she said that, you know, I don't know why I told this story. And he basically indicated that the story was not correct. So they had essentially just that story to go by. And it was a story that both of them were disavowing at that point as far as his confession. And it was something that, again, the physical evidence did not back up. There was not anything to indicate this graphic rape and murder taking place in Stephen Avery's trailer and so on. There was nothing to indicate that any of that had ever happened. So, ultimately, they tried to mix in some other physical evidence as well, as they did at the other trial. But Ken Kratz was prosecuting, and I found this to be very, very surprising. He was prosecuting a completely separate case vis-a-vis the legal evidence at the kid's trial as he was Stephen Avery's trial. At Stephen Avery's trial, officially, the Brandon Dassey story never happened. Jurors, you are not to think about all that lurid stuff that I already put in your ear holes about how this guy did it and here's how, and he collaborated with his nephew to rape and murder her in the most gruesome way possible and then desecrate her body. At the kid's trial, that's all he was pushing. He was pushing, this is how it happened. He said that. He wouldn't have said it if it didn't happen. His cousin corroborates it, even though she's lying now. And again, that just makes it much more complicated. I mean, either that Kayla Avery was lying at trial, or she was lying when she first set the thing in motion as far as the ticking time bomb of Brandon Dassey's conscience. So that's one of these things where ultimately you're in a tough spot believing something either way when she's either saying I lied now, not then, and the prosecution is saying she's lying now and not then. But it was a completely different set of circumstances at the kid's trial. And the prosecution really just kind of had a field day with it. And the kid's representation, he did end up subsequently with better lawyers than he had initially. But this Len Kaczynski, you talk about somebody that has become one of the biggest public enemies on the Internet right now. And it's kind of unfortunate that subsequently in real life, I guess the guy is battling for his life. He's got leukemia, and he's getting a lot of death threats now and everything, which, you know, to an extent, you're going to have that. I mean, it's unfortunate. That's the day and age we live in.